You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
So thanks everyone for coming. We have three guests today. We're here for a major conference at the Columbia University on free speech jurisprudence around the world. Peter Norlander and Nani Janssen are from the Media Legal Defense Initiative, which has been in existence for?
Since 2008.
As a separate entity.
Yes.
I think we can take some pride in saying that the idea grew out of some brainstorming within this organization, and it was initially housed, I think it was Arya's idea and the media program, and with some assistance from the Justice Initiative, helped conceive of it and house it for a while. But it is now one of the many successful spin-off stories. MLDI was just awarded last night at Columbia. They just instituted this award for what is it?
Excellence in legal services and freedom of expression globally.
So that's one part of it. It's basically meant the best litigants of the year in a major free speech case. And there's also another half of it that goes to the courts that decided major. It doesn't have to be the same court in the same case. The two courts that were recognized last night was a sort of an ex aequo between the Turkish Constitutional Court over the unblocking of Twitter and YouTube, and the Zimbabwean Supreme Court over a case outlawing, was it criminal defamation,
yeah,
or some aspect of criminal defamation. And MLDI was recognized, was awarded for their role in probably the single most important case of last year, a ruling by the African Court of Human Rights in Konate versus Burkina Faso, which you're going to hear more about shortly. And we also had the good fortune to have here Dirk Verhoef, who is a law professor and a political affairs lecturer in splitting his time between Ghent University and Copenhagen University. Dirk is one of the closest observers and one of the more astute commentators on Article 10 of the European Convention of Human Rights, which Dirk likes to call somewhat provocatively Europe's First Amendment. So we'll hear from Dirk afterwards about what are the main trends at free speech wise at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg. But we'll start with Peter and Nani. Peter.
Okay. So Darian, you were far too modest, because it was really you and Sandy and, of course, Arya, who were the instigators of our organization, the Media Legal Defense Initiative, together with the media program, Stuart, over in London, and Gordana. And we were set up because there was a real need for an organization that is specifically focused on providing legal assistance and legal defense, and making sure that journalists around the world, when they are under legal threat specifically, that there are specialist lawyers available to defend them, to do a good job, and to stand by them throughout the trial, and to make sure not only that the case that they're involved in is then won, but that the journalists concerned can continue their reporting. And that is actually, for us as an organization, is something that we are becoming more and more focused on. It's almost although we're an organization of lawyers and we love winning cases, because that's what we do as lawyers, the outcome further down the line, which is far more important, is making sure that journalist can then continue to do their work and isn't hounded out of the profession or even out of their country. And that does actually have implications in terms of how we approach cases. And sometimes it's better to advise a journalist to just settle a case and get on with their lives rather than, you know, fight that sharp and often very necessary fight to promote freedom of expression. But sometimes it's not the wisest thing to do. Anyway, I will just take a few minutes because I don't want to take any time away from Nani or from Dirk to set out kind of the overall environment that we work in and what we see as the key challenges, but also what we see as the key sort of opportunities in terms of where things can move forward. And we're at, you know, as regards challenges, CPJ put out their annual press freedom reports. Last year was the year with the second highest number of journalists in prison, so that clearly is a key challenge. The challenge of violence against journalists is a trend that continues, and the overall diminishing of a respect for the rule of law generally. You know, if you look at developments in Russia, but also in places like India and in other, you know, large and important countries, the challenge isn't just to media freedom. The challenge is to the rule of law and to respect for human rights. And media freedom is at the forefront of that because it's the, you know, journalists are the canary in the coal mine. And it is that indicator. This is why freedom of expression is so important. It is that indicator of levels of respect for democracy generally. And if you see in a country that journalists are being targeted and that respect for media freedom is going down, that usually means that there are larger underlying problems. How does that manifest itself? It manifests itself in ways that are both old and new. So for us as lawyers, I've been working on freedom of expression issues since sort of the early 2000s, and we see a lot of the same problems have remained exactly the same. It's the abuse of defamation laws. If we examine our dockets, percentage-wise, the overwhelming majority of cases are defamation cases. It is so easy to bring a case against a journalist who has written a story. It is very easy for the person that's the target of the story, and often they are their local mayors or their local prosecutors or their sort of people in what I like to think of as middle management in government. they're often the very sensitive ones, and it's very easy for them when they're being criticized to just lodge a case and say, that's not true, prove it. And the laws in most of the countries around the world are place a very heavy burden on the journalist or on the media outlet concerned to prove to a criminal standard of proof sometimes, which means that that's a very high standard of proof to bring evidence that the story was indeed true. That challenge is I think a constant challenge, and is one that in the sort of the media freedom or freedom of expression world we are still struggling with, and that is why the case that Nani will be talking about later at the African Court of Human Rights is so important, because it is still extremely important to chip away at those really repressive libel laws. So that is one thing. And there's a use of national security laws that is increasingly prevalent, particularly in Western societies, and the use of public order laws, again, against journalists, as well as manifestations thereof that are sometimes country-specific. So in places like Rwanda, national security / public order gets merged with genocide denial and what they call divisionism. So, but in essence, these are all manifestations of national security laws that place, again, very heavy burdens on journalists and place very sort of thick red lines through what can and cannot be reported in the media. So that's a whole sort of packet of all challenges that we're all working on. The internet, of course, has brought a whole bunch of new challenges as well as a whole bunch of new opportunities. We spent the last 2 days at Columbia University talking about some of those. You know, there was a really exciting panel on the right to be forgotten, which has come up as a real threat to media freedom and to freedom of expression. There are issues around the extent to which media companies or media websites are liable for comments left by their users. And people go to prison for that. You know, there were cases in Thailand, most prominently, where a website editor faced 20 years in prison for comments that were left by their users, which were defamatory of the Thai king. And those are challenges that didn't exist 15 years ago, or they weren't as prominent, and they're certainly coming to the fore. But with those challenges, there's also, actually no, those are a bunch of legal challenges. There are very practical challenges for an organization such as ourselves as well. The main practical challenge is actually finding good lawyers to work with, and retaining those lawyers and building their skills. This is a problem that actually I've been struck with, that's a problem not just for us, because we're an NGO, and I used to think, oh, it's just because we can't pay much. But it's a problem that even big media companies struggle with. When you have a case against you in Kenya, to name a random country, or in the Philippines, or in Malaysia, just finding that there's a very small pool of lawyers, A, that are willing to take the cases, but then finding the ones that are actually good at it is so hard. And that, again, in the Burkina Faso case was a real issue, was finding the right, finding a lawyer who was willing to represent the journalist to stand by him. And that is a real challenge.
Is that because of the sort of the high stakes politically, or is it a question of the legal profession, that there's no media bar as such, there's no media to sustain them?
It is both those things, definitely. But it is the legal culture and the culture that lawyers work in some of these countries is just a completely different culture. And some of the lawyers behave in ways that are... I mean, I'm a lawyer. Lawyers have massive egos, right? And they all think that they're the best thing since sliced bread. And don't tell a lawyer how to run a case, because they're just not going to listen. And I can deal with all of that, right? That's all of that is fine. But when you combine an ego like that with the fact is that they aren't as good as they think they are, usually. But they're actually not as good as they think they are to an astonishingly high degree, and they.
It's just the lack of specialization.
It's a lack of specialization. There is a.
It's also very basic training, very often.
Exactly.
It's and sometimes also a reluctance of more senior lawyers to take junior lawyers under their wing and teach them, the tricks of the trade, so to speak. Because a lot of the things that you actually learn is when you start practicing, right? And you need a good mentor for that, you need good training, and that is often lacking.
Peter, what's the texture of how these things get adjudicated? And, in the U.S. we're obviously focused on motion practice and discovery and all that sort of thing. Are most of these coming up as criminal cases where they're going straight to trial, or is there motion practice? And because this goes to the competency of lawyers.
It really depends on country to country.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
David McCraw, New York Times.
We did a very quick round. And with Monroe Price over there, who's a media law professor. And
I'm Jeremy Kenner, I'm also at the New York Times.
Great.
That is so different, the answer to that is so different from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
But it is often, journalists are at a bigger disadvantage in the countries where we work, and I should have said that we focus most of our work in Asia, Africa, and Central and Eastern Europe, at the moment anyway. And the sort of the inequality of arms, as it were, is far more pronounced, and that's either because people get to spend time in pretrial detention for way longer than they should, but it's also because the legal assistance available to them there isn't that high caliber of lawyers out there that can defend them. So that is just to say that in practical terms, that's a real challenge for us, is just finding the right people to work with. But when you then find them, that becomes a real opportunity, because the people the way that we work, we've got a very small office in London. There's eight of us now. There's actually only three lawyers. And we work through networks, and we work through people, you know, together with people like Kathy, who's sitting here, who do fantastic work in Uganda, but also people like Dirk, who's sitting here, who's incredibly generous with his time and advises on cases and advises on strategy, particularly at European Court of Human Rights level. And I think that is actually, that's a real opportunity, because there is, once you found the good lawyers to work with, there is a tremendous appetite and so much goodwill, and people want to, partly they want to be involved in the cases because they're often inherently interesting, but it's also because they often provide an opportunity to move the law forward. And I wanted to just...
Can I ask you, Peter, can you also use this network of International Media Lawyers Association? Do you often work with people which belong to that network, or most of the time outside?
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Absolutely. It doesn't cover enough countries, so that's a real problem. And sometimes the memberships are a little bit out of date, so you people tend to move on sometimes. But that's really like IMLA, and
so the reactivated more. Or
well, I think there's definitely an opportunity for that, absolutely, and to expand it to new countries as well. And so working on ways of doing that. So there's an opportunity there. There are other opportunities in terms of moving things forward. I started by saying that the reality on the ground is very harsh at the moment, and there's a real downward pressure at several, politically downward pressures that are very powerful. But at the same time, that there are opportunities, and there is really interesting constitutional litigation in places where you wouldn't expect it, like Zimbabwe. Like Zambia, where courts are actually willing to stand up and push back at that and sort of stand up for constitutional values. And I would identify that as a, you got to push at where things are going well, you need to push that further, right? And I would really identify that as one area to push. That's a constitutional litigation, as well as the litigation before international human rights courts. And that is in Africa. There are really interesting regional tribunals, as well as continent-wide courts that have been established. And, the European Court of Human Rights, which still is a leader in this field, it is much criticized for all sorts of reasons, but it's still fundamentally a force for good in Europe, and that continues to be incredibly needed.
Can you say a little more on the regional courts in Africa? Does the ECOWAS court or SADC court play a role here?
Absolutely. And I think Nani will talk a little bit more about the African regional courts, because she's litigating it at the East African Court of Justice, and she's also building a couple of cases at ECOWAS, and Barbarian, you have experience of litigating at ECOWAS as well. So I don't want to steal Nani's thunder.
Okay. So, I don't know if you're doing anything at the Southern African Court. That's a little bit of a sad story, but...
There's not much to be done there anymore, right? As a human rights court, that's dead, right? So.
It's in a hiatus.
Yeah. Well, temporary coma.
A different question. How much you encounter in your work referencing of security laws in the US or surveillance as a kind of defense and justification for adopting that kind of legislation in African countries?
I think in Ethiopia that's very pronounced, for example, where the anti-terror laws are used on a daily basis against activists and journalists, and they were drafted by US, UK experts.
I'll say a bit more about that.
Okay. Right. Yeah. Okay.
And Kenya is an issue these days.
Yeah, Kenya.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think I started us off on a slightly unusual format here, with too many questions. So we'll let you do your presentation.
I just figured I'd just say that I'm going to.
And then we'll collect more information. No, so I think it makes for a more interesting conversation. But
that's good.
Keep it not under.
Yeah. Actually, I might as well hand over to you at this point.
Yeah. We have question time after this anyway, so we
can talk about
everything a little bit more. Because I actually listed like three of our cases in Africa, three different mechanisms, just as a kind of nice little package. which Peter didn't mention yet, is that we have about 100 cases on our docket at any one time in between 40 and 50 different jurisdictions. So we litigate all over, and not just at these bodies that I'll talk about now, but also at the European Court, at the UN Human Rights Committee, various of the UN special mechanisms. So there's also all of that. But I'm happy to talk more about that if anyone's interested during the Q&A or afterwards. So just feel free to ask. The three cases that I listed are the case at the African Court on Human and People's Rights, Conate versus Burkina Faso. A case that we have pending at the East African Court of Justice that's filed by the Burundi Journalist Union challenging the press law in the country. And the third one is an African Commission case against Ethiopia brought on behalf of Iskinder Nega and Riyot Alemu. I'll give you a little bit of background on the facts and then how the litigation went at the court and give you a bit of background on how that worked in practice. And then, you know, we can talk about it in more detail if you like. So the Konate decision, which was handed down in December last year, is the result of Mr. Konate having served a year in prison for writing two articles that were critical of a public prosecutor in the nation's capital, Ouagadougou. He alleged that the prosecutor had been involved in corruption. The prosecutor filed a criminal complaint. He was criminally prosecuted. The prosecutor also joined the case as a civil party, so that resulted in a prison sentence of a year, the closure of his newspaper, and the obligation to pay damages and fines amounting to 18 times the average annual salary in the country. So we kind of got to know of the case because CPJ reported on the initial conviction, and we then reached, you know, through CPJ's contacts, we got in touch with the lawyer and said, like, can we do anything to support it? You should appeal, obviously, and they did. Unfortunately, this was one of those situations where the lawyers weren't very thorough in their legal strategy. Their main strategy was basically to kind of apologize and then hope that the judge would let him off. Which, in all honesty, had worked a couple of times before. But this time it didn't. I kept on suggesting that we really also file a substantive defense, but really that wasn't a good idea. Once the conviction was upheld, I spoke to the lawyer about the option and said, what do you want to do? How do you want to escalate this? They're like, no, you know, it's not going to work. Never mind. So fortunately, someone else was willing to go and visit Mr. Konate in prison and present the possibility of taking the case to either the ECOWAS Court of Justice or the African Court. And he authorized us directly to do that for him, which we did. We filed in June 2013, had another written exchange. Burkina Faso responded, we responded to that, and then we basically had a hearing in March last year. So that went relatively quick, which is nice. The court is quite young. It doesn't have a huge caseload, so it can actually be efficient. I'll tell you a little bit more about the hearing just for the timeline. So that was March, and then in December we got a judgment. We first thought we'd have it in September, but something went wrong there, and then we ended up getting it in December. So I think that's relatively quick for an international tribunal, particularly if you compare it to other courts which have, you know, a much larger caseload. The procedure there is the court is very accessible. It's easy to deal with in the sense that you can file electronically to meet your deadline and then subsequently send in your signed documents. So that's really nice and flexible. The registry could do a little bit with a little bit of upscaling, I think. Communications aren't always clear. It's not always clear what's being communicated to the other party in the case. You know, you sometimes don't get copies of letters. Sometimes you do. They often tell you that they had informed you about something, which they haven't. So that requires a bit of chasing up from time to time.
Hearings at 5 days' notice?
Yeah. The hearing we had in March, we got notified of, you know, sufficiently in advance in January. The hearing what we were supposed to have on September 1st for the reading of the judgment and ended up having in December, we were notified of just really, really late. I think literally 5 days in advance, which, oddly enough, actually for us flying in from London, isn't that difficult because you can fly to Africa fairly easily, but travel within Africa, as most of you will know, is pretty difficult. So if you have a regional court where you would like the actual complainants to actually be able to attend hearings, that's kind of tricky to not give enough advance notice. So those are, you know, some of the challenges that are there. The rules of procedure are fairly good. They're not entirely clear on all points. We had a wonderful coalition of amici in intervening in the case. But, for example, the rules of procedure say that you can file an amicus brief, but it doesn't say when you should file your request, what should be in the request, or anything. So, you know, that leaves room for flexibility, but also leaves things a little bit unclear for people. So, yeah, those are things that just could be refined, I would say. So I'll leave it at that for the moment. Oh, no, I do want to say something about the judgment, actually.
Judgment, yes.
Yeah. Minor detail. It's the only case that I can say something about the judgment that I have on my list here. So the judgment, what we basically did was argue an enormous amount of comparative law examples, because this was the first time that the African Court was looking at an explicit freedom of expression case. I mean, they looked at a case concerning a journalist before, also against Burkina Faso, the Zongo case, but that concerned the murder and lack of failure to investigate. And criminal defamation, of course, that there's a decriminalization campaign going on, and so this was kind of a thing. So we invited them to look at the standards that had been established by the European Court, Inter-American Court, UN Human Rights Committee, and also higher level national courts worldwide. And basically said, like, look, the baseline here is that everyone has said that imprisonment for defamation is not acceptable, that penalties have to be proportionate, this is where you have to start. But we invite you to, go further and basically say that criminal defamation as such violates free speech. Here are, resolution standards, etc., that basically point to that. They didn't go that far in total, but what's really interesting is that 4 out of 10 judges wrote a dissenting opinion actually saying this. They basically said, okay, criminal defamation, you don't need it. Once you get to the point where the speech is so offensive and awful and so on that it would merit criminal sanctions, you get to the point where it's protected, where this is prescribed by other articles in the criminal law, such as hate speech and things like that. So you don't need criminal defamation. And I think that's a really wonderful thing to take note of. And also it shows the potential, I think, of the court and, thinking progressively about human rights. So that's something that hopefully will be tapped into further. Another thing that's, of course, we now have this, so now it's time to kind of use it in national proceedings. I think the day or so after we got the judgment, we already got requests from, I think it was from Senegal, to provide them with the text. We've had a request from India and other countries in Africa to kind of use it. I know that in Uganda some criminal proceedings have been suspended because the lawyer there learned about the judgment and basically said, like, so... How about dismissing this case? So that's wonderful. So there's a lot of potential to create further impact with this decision. And
Is it right that is this the furthest that any international tribunal has ever gone in saying no prison terms for speech offenses?
No, I'm not saying it's the furthest. I'm saying that they're aligning themselves with the European and Inter-American Courts and the UN.
No, but have they actually gone further? Because I don't think the European Court has ever said that in such absolute terms.
Okay. Well, this is what they said anyway. Yeah. So that maybe they are more progressive in that sense. I mean, the sense that I got is that this really basically is the standard. I don't know.
I feel that they're sitting on the... I'm kind of waiting for the English language translation to come out as well, because my French, I can read it, but it's, it's not very sophisticated. My sense is that they're sitting at the European...
Yeah. But it's definitely cutting edge.
But the dissent of the four is really interesting, and that kind of sets up... Some interesting future stuff, and the same four also voted one of, as an interim measure, we requested, this was while Konaté was still in prison, we requested
that
he be released pending the decision of the court. you're sort of saying, you know, he'll go back to prison if you find that this doesn't violate his right. He'll go back to prison, and we almost got that interim measure.
Yeah, we basically, you know, that the standard for interim measures is pretty high, right? The threshold. I mean, it's, you know, if there's a danger of imminent harm, torture, death, and that sort of thing. But, you know, we figured this is give it a try, and basically say, like, look, this is irreversible. He's in prison; he can't get that time back. So there is no risk, basically, in letting him out while these proceedings are pending. If the court holds that his conviction was okay, he can always serve the rest of his prison term. And the four indeed said, like, yeah, this makes sense. So there's some interesting thinking going on in the panel there, and I think that's
And has he been released now?
He has served his full term because he already served about 2/3 of his term when we filed the case. We had hoped a little bit that the government would have been like, okay, let's just kind of release him, because he would have been eligible for early release. Actually, he was for quite some time. He filed numerous requests to that end, but they all got denied. It just really seemed very much like they were really adamant about, you know, handing down the highest possible penalties that there were possible under Burkina Bay law, and also really letting him serve his entire term. There was just, like, really clearly sending a message there. So.
And he had been deserted by his own lawyers. Definitely.
Yeah,
happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, anyway, moving on. I just wanted to flag the case at the East African Court of Justice that we also filed in 2013, actually a month after we filed Konaté. Burundi is in elections at the moment, and in 2013 they adopted a number of laws kind of restricting space for discussion about the elections. So they adopted a very oppressive press law, they adopted really restrictive laws for civil society in the country, etc. The press law had been challenged nationally at the Constitutional Court, which came with a kind of nice cosmetic decision basically saying, oh, yes, these three articles that are completely procedural are clearly unconstitutional. The rest is totally fine. So the law actually establishes prior censorship, disproportionate penalties and fines. There's a body overseeing the implementation of the press law that's entirely appointed by the president's office. So there's no real independence going on there. We had a hearing on that case last month. And we hope to get a judgment next month in April this year. The East African Court of Justice is less accessible. We've had enormous trouble getting our filing in. We can speculate about the reasons for that, but anyone who's doing anything there, we can talk about that separately. Once the case was in, though, the case was handled really expeditiously. We had the reason that it got delayed so far was because Burundi responded out of time. It's interesting, they have several cases pending at the East African Court, but they seem very confused about how things work. To a certain extent, I have to say, their rules of procedure aren't very clear. It's a bit difficult when you get answers from the registry saying, but clearly you have to do such and such according to rule XYZ, and rule XYZ really doesn't seem to say anything about it. So that sometimes is a bit difficult. You have to, when you file, you have to serve all documents on all the parties, which is also a little bit different from what I'm used to with most international courts, which distribute pleadings that have been filed. So it's a slightly different system, and, for us it was just kind of challenging, but you can also see that partner states are struggling with it. Burundi never has managed to actually serve documents on us within any time frame that they were supposed to. But I mean, eventually we got them, and it's fine. But they should perhaps consider making that a little bit more easy to manage for people. The judges I have a very good impression of. I went to both the scheduling conference. It's kind of an interesting hybrid between kind of an arbitration and proper, a court-driven procedure, because the parties actually get to set the deadlines. They get to decide together whether or not they want to do everything in writing, if they want to have a hearing, etc. and to set the timelines for it. So that's really nice. They're very sharp. There's a panel of three, and the court also has an appellate chamber. So that is clearly something at the hearing that they look towards. Some of the questions that we got, for example, we introduced the Konaté decision as an authority during the hearing. It was like, okay, but like, how are we supposed to use this? You know, what are we bound by this other court or by our own appellate chamber? Like, no, it's persuasive authority, of course, etc. So it's really interesting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing how that works out.
And who's the client in this? Because I think the other peculiar thing about this case is that you're challenging the whole law, right?
Yes.
As such, which is not something that too many international tribunals do.
Well, this is another thing indeed. Before that, actually, there is another thing I should mention, and that's that the East African Court of Justice is a regional economic court, which hasn't been given explicit human rights jurisdiction just yet. There is a protocol for that, but the partner states are not ratifying it. So the court can actually, has interpreted its mandate as such that it can actually hear human rights cases if the claim is a violation of one of the treaty articles, and it's usually Article 5, 6, or 7, which deal with the community principles of transparency, democracy, rule of law, etc. If it happens to also relate to a human right, they say it's fine, you can listen. And there's steady case law on that, which has been upheld by their appellate chamber as well. What we did basically was say press freedom is a cornerstone of those principles. Therefore, the press law violates the right of, you know, the obligation to uphold principles of transparency, rule of law, etc., etc. We challenged specific articles of the law, so we didn't say like, okay, you have to get rid of it wholesale. We explained exactly which ones were the ones that were you know, in violation of the treaty obligations in our eyes, and basically asked the court to strike them down or order Burundi to amend them. And this is also something that they seem to be keen on doing, but also were struggling a little bit as to how they needed
Was
to go about it.
Was there any requirement that you exhaust remedies in the national courts?
No, there is not. Like ECOWAS, you can actually access the court directly, regardless of what's pending at the national level. This is an argument that Burundi kept on making, and we kept on pointing out that those were two completely different things, and that moreover, national domestic remedies had actually been exhausted. So, I know that there's very little time, right? I don't
yes.
want to.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you could,
yeah. I'll be very super super brief about the African Commission case, which is still pending against Ethiopia, brought on behalf of Iskender Nega, who's been convicted to 18 years imprisonment under the anti-terrorism law, and Riyot Alemu, whose sentence has been reduced to 4 years, but both of them had got charged basically after publishing, normal journalistic pieces. Nothing even, remotely out of line. Iskender wrote an op-ed, a blog, asking if perhaps one day something like the Arab Spring could happen in Ethiopia. And Riyot's last publication questioned the fundraising that was taking place by the Ethiopian government for building a hydroelectric dam. The evidence that was presented against them in the national trials basically consisted of their journalistic writing. It was very clear that those terrorism charges were because of their journalistic work. And just to come back to the question about like the legislation and so the. The kind of the running theme in by the Ethiopian government about their legislation is, but it's based on the UK law, it's based on the US law, okay, but by taking out any of the articles in those laws that offer some sort of checks and balances there. And also then, as we argued in our submissions there, it's also about implementation. And if you look at what has been happening in Ethiopia over the past years, under the anti-terrorism law, since it was adopted in 2013, you see that it's used as a blanket excuse to, shut down newspapers, imprison people, etc. So we actually tried to get the case referred to the African court, arguing that it was a systematic violation of human rights, which didn't work. The commission basically said, okay, the Ethiopia didn't ratify the protocol established in the court, so we can't do a referral. Because, as you know, they can refer if there is a systematic violation or if a country doesn't implement the measures that were ordered by the Commission. So we're still at the Commission, and we're at the admissibility stage. We hope to get a decision on that after their April session, and then to move on towards arguing the merits. The Commission, I don't know if any of you has litigated there. It's not very transparent what goes on. It's not very clear how long it will take them to actually reach decisions in various stages. I think also that there is still a lot of work to be done in clarifying the relationship between the Commission and the court. You know, there are only 7 countries that made the declaration allowing direct petitions to the African court. So the only other route that you have, basically, is to get to the court is via the Commission. And yeah, they've been testing the waters a bit there. During the December session, this was the first time actually that a case that was referred to the court actually got, you know, presented before it by the Commission. There's this weird thing that the original complainant gets overtaken by the Commission. So you file a case with the Commission. If the Commission thinks you should go to the court, the commission takes it to the court.
They'd like the Inter-American system.
Yeah, so you're kind of out of the... But there's no real formal role anymore for the person who originally filed. So, but that seems to have worked with the case against Kenya in December. So maybe now they'll get a bit more comfortable and we might see more referrals. I'll stop.
It took the Inter-American system also quite a bit of time to introduce some role for the party. So now the parties are also they can participate in the hearing and make arguments.
Yeah.
But it's sort of
in the works.
secondary to the Commission.
Yeah, I think the group who originally filed the Kenya case got to make some sort of statement in the end, but that was also something that was kind of decided last minute at the session itself. There were some of the complainants there to give, you know, witness testimony, which of course is also useful, but it's in under construction.
It's also got its benefits, especially if your lawyers are not great in the first, because the Commission sort of takes over. Great, thanks for that. So Derek, we've asked her to do a whirlwind tour of the sort of the most salient issues at the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, including if you can, as we discussed, the question of access to information as a right under Article 10, which is something that various parts of OSI have worked to develop and have a keen interest. I hope that something is of interest for the broader audience.
Well, I would like briefly to introduce the position of the European Court, which was also part of the reporting at our conference. It's 48 member states. It's about 900 million people who are under the jurisdiction of the European Convention on Human Rights, monitored by the Human Rights Court. Maybe I have in a moment also possibility to say something about the Court of Justice, because we see that the Court of Justice, which is the EU court, also more and more gets involved in human rights issues. It was a bit the situation that you compared with the East African Court. The European Court of Justice could only deal with EU law, with the internal market, but the rules had to be applied in accordance to the principles of the European Convention. And since we have the Charter of Fundamental Rights in the EU, this, of course, has become an integral part of many, many cases. And we see also freedom of expression, data protection, copyright law, getting in this area. So this is a very interesting moving area, also the relation between the European Court and Strasbourg, Human Rights Court, and the Court of Justice in Luxembourg. There's an interesting dynamic going on. There's a harsh conflict even now due to an opinion by the Court of Justice, who wants to put itself above the European Convention on Human Rights. Just to say that there's a lot of dynamic and movement.
Is that over the EU becoming a party, formally a party?
Because in the new treaty, it is mentioned that the EU will become a member of the convention. And they have been working 4 years now to make a draft agreement between the EU and the Council of Europe and European court, and on that issue, the Court of Justice, that was the agreement, would make an opinion. And on 10 points, they find that this agreement would be in breach with EU law in this area of human rights. And the conditions that the Court of Justice proposes make that it's unacceptable for the other member states, because it puts the EU law in some concern, in some perspective above the European Convention. Maybe it would lead too far to go into detail, but it's a very interesting dynamic which is going on. So for the moment, there is a total blockage. We don't know yet what will happen now. They need to sit around the table again, but it's very unclear what direction it will take. But that's a bit the general picture. Also, just to mention, because the African Court just delivered its first judgment. We are around 1,000 judgments by now at the European Court of Human Rights. Last year, I counted 55 judgments related to freedom of expression, media, and journalism, of which 46 European Court found a violation. So when you look at that quantitative score, you can say the court makes a difference, because it means that in 46 cases, the victims of a violation and interference with their right of freedom of expression, they lost their case after exhaustion of all national remedies in their own country, but European Court monitored, scrutinized the case and found a violation by that member state in relation to Article 10, freedom of expression. And some general trends in 2014 were discovered, and I especially put two on the agenda also 2 days ago. That is, one, protection of whistleblowers, because we found out the last few years that at the national level there is an insufficient protection of whistleblowers. And the European Court of Human Rights took this issue and has started to protect whistleblowers under the right of freedom of expression. And in a series of cases now, which were successful for the whistleblowers, the European Court found violations at the level, a protection level that was not acquired at the domestic level. So that's one, and we have seen again in 2014 a very interesting case against Hungary, Matus versus Hungary, which was also elected as the best judgment on Strasbourg observers. I mentioned it, so there's a lot of support. It's a very important signal by the European Court that the member states need to go one step further in more effectively protecting whistleblowers at the domestic level. And there's also a recommendation or a declaration by the Council of Europe to take more steps to effectively protect whistleblowers. Of course, Article 10 doesn't refer to whistleblowers. It has been a kind of a creative interpretation. The convention as a living instrument, we need nowadays to make the convention practical and effective, and that means also that you need to protect whistleblowers, because they're at the very beginning, at the source of the free flow of information. And when we are there, at the very source of information, we also have the other issue, access to information. European Convention doesn't mention the right to seek or the right to have access to information. It only refers to the right to express, impart, and receive information. So during very many years, the European Court has produced a very consistent case law affirming that the right of access to information was not covered by Article 10. There is not the reference like in Article 19 in ICCPR, the right to seek. There was no way to open Article 10 into a right of access to information. There were some
access to government information.
Access to public documents. Yeah, we need to clarify that. Access to official documents, public documents, was excluded, because it was said it's only information that others want to offer to you that should not be interfered with, but when there is no will to offer information, that you cannot enforce through Article 10 of the Convention. And in 2005, even a Grand Chamber judgment against the UK, Roach against the UK, confirmed this point of view. So it looked in 2005, when I was giving classes on the right of access to information, that was the end of the story. There is no right of access to information under Article 10, so it depends from the mostly very often unwilling member states how they apply their domestic law, which was very insufficient. Maybe it was good on paper, but the practice did not function. So it would have been very nice if it could be scrutinized by the European Court, but precisely therefore the Court was unwilling to do it because the member states didn't want to have that kind of watchdog on how they dealt with confidential information and official documents. But then, very strange, and that's due to good lawyers, I think, who thought, well, we don't stop with this. Even if there is a Grand Chamber judgment, the European Convention is a living instrument, and many NGOs also were advocating that the European Court should take up its role to bridge the gap of the deficiency at national level to bring it to a higher level. And first, in an inadmissibility decision, the Court implicitly, but still, applied Article 10, and short time later, then in a judgment against Hungary, the Court stated by saying it is difficult to derive from Article 10 a right of access to public documents, but we know what is difficult in life is not impossible. And the Court said, but there have been some developments in our case law. They need to justify the curve of 180 degrees they made in 2 years' time, and taking distance from a Grand Chamber judgment. That was quite a big step in applying Article 10, again in a case introduced by an NGO, the Human Rights, Civil Rights Organization in Hungary, in which the Court not only applied Article 10, but also found a violation of Article 10 because that NGO was refused access to a document which at that time was in the possession of the Constitutional Court. And ever since, NGOs, journalists, academics have used Article 10 as a tool to apply in Strasbourg. And we have seen again in 2014 an interesting case of Rusianu, where again the Court has confirmed this right of access, and there's a very recent case also where this is done. There's one disclaimer in this. The European Court has not recognized in general terms until now a separate right of access to public documents. It is derived from the right, when it's a journalist who wants to write a book or an article, to express information, to make information available to the public. That is the justification that you need to have access to the information that you want to integrate in your report. So it is a bit a secondary right.
But not only a journalist, right? A historian, an NGO.
Absolutely. So and when it's a journalist, and it's also a historian, it has been used. And the Court has used a strong image, though, in this, that is that a monopoly over information as such is a breach of Article 10. So if the government is the only one, or public authorities who have information in their possession, which is of public interest, because that's always the link, it's with the idea to share that information with the public because there is a public interest involved with that information, then it's not acceptable that the authorities only keep that information for themselves, and they have to share it with journalists, with NGOs, with academics, with historians who requested for that information. And what is also important in some of these cases, I think, is that there is a connection between Article 10, right of access to information, and Article 13, a right to effective remedies. Because many of these cases are concerned also with Article 13, because many states in Europe have very good acts, laws at national level on paper guaranteeing right of access to public documents, of course with a set of limitations, but in practice it's not functioning. The limitations are interpreted overbroad, or you don't get an answer, and there are no effective remedies, or there's no access to court, there's no judicial review to enforce your right. So, and that is what the European Court in some of these cases also has found, that it's not sufficient to have it on paper, You need to have strong, effective remedies to enforce your right within a short period to have the information, and the member states, the authorities, need to motivate very precisely why in this case they refuse the access to information. So we, in 10 years' time, I would say, we have seen an enormous interesting development in this area, and it makes that now the member states, they cannot consider themselves anymore where the limits are. And a very good example of that is a case against Serbia, where a human rights organization wanted to have information of the intelligence services, how many cases of surveillance they had with regard to politicians and journalists. And the intelligence service of Serbia, they first refused to answer, and then they said, we don't keep these records, we don't have that. And if they continued asking it to commissioner, they still refused to hand over that information. And they went to Strasbourg, and the Strasbourg court said that even information in possession of intelligence services is covered under the right of access to public documents. So that was an important step forward. And secondly, it was serious. According to the European Court, this right has to be taken serious. So it imposed an order on the Serbian government within a short period to hand over the information to the NGO requesting for that information. So it's a good example also where the European Court is trying to practically enforce their judgments and their finding of a violation of somewhere very abstract, and that the member state need to pay a fine or award of damages. But they start also to connect orders and effective instruments they integrate to impose their decisions on the member states who are clearly unwilling to implement them otherwise. So that's a bit the story.
Great, yeah. Thanks. So I'll open it up to questions in a second, but in solving sort of this mystery of what happened between the Grand Chamber in 2005 saying, no, we've said clearly there's no such right, and in 2007, the Hungarian case turning it sort of around slowly. Yeah. What do you think might be the relevance, if any, of the Inter-American Court deciding in the interim in 2006, I think, that there is a right of a full right of access under the American Convention?
Well, I think there were two things which happened, and that also shows that the European Court integrates civil society arguments and policy documents from within the Council of Europe. Because the first one is that more and more NGOs in Europe were knocking on the door of the Council of Europe, that also we needed a higher level to take one step further in enforcing the right of access to information, and that Article 10 could play an important role in that. Or Article 10, or a European Convention on access to official documents. So these were the two tracks which were open. And then there was a recommendation of 2002 already by the Committee of Ministers, but that got some follow-up by an expert committee that advocated to use Article 10 also as an instrument for enforcement of right of access to information. And maybe a third element, but the European Court is not willing to admit it explicitly, and that is the case of Claude Reyes versus Chile in 2006, which is just in the middle of 2005 and 2007, in the case in which the Inter-American Court of Human Rights recognized under the Inter-American Convention a right of access to information. So probably the judges in Europe who have the perception that we are always in the lead of extending human rights and freedom of expression, all at once we found behind the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. Mm-hmm. So there was no explicit reference, neither in the case against the Czech Republic, neither in the cases against Hungary, but I'm sure that the judges were aware of this judgment, and together with the other material I refer to, that probably played a role that they couldn't uphold anymore this too rigid attitude that they had until 2005. So it's probably a combination. Maybe only one bird in the Inter-American Court wouldn't have made the difference, but all the elements together, the advocacy in Europe itself, strong cases, because that's maybe also something that is applicable to your experience, bring strong cases to produce new creative applications of Article 10. And it was strong case. It was a strong case, this Hungarian case, the first two Hungarian cases. So that also makes it easier. Were good guys. It was really an issue of public interest. There were some tools at the national level which hadn't functioned. So that probably made the European Court in a very good mood to go one step further and the other direction even. Yeah.
I love the justification by the Hungarian courts. They said this was a petition by a member of parliament that was refused.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, if you read this petition, you will get an insight into his inner thinking, and that's part of privacy. And maybe he should have chosen a different profession.
So I think another factor that changed between 2005 and 2008 was a change in the membership of the judges at the European Court, in particular that Andras Sajo joined the court and became the author of this decision. And I think it's... actually, we don't know that he was the author of the decision, but I think it reflects a certain kind of leadership, and it's fair enough to report that membership of the court can be a factor.
Yeah, and maybe because you mentioned, more and more research is started now and is done in Europe as well, and you're very familiar with it in the United States, what the individual role of the judges is, and to try to find out when they belong to majority, conquering or dissenting opinions, what their profile is, what is their background. So some more sociological studies as well of the importance of the membership of the European Court. So it's also a very important issue for the future, because we know that, let's say, the political landscape is changing in Europe. We have more and more political parties focusing on national identity, protection of national policy, reducing the role of the European Court, and there's a strong movement to represent judges to the European Court who are more in favor of this approach and leave more subsidiarity, leave more margin of appreciation to the member states. And I am aware of a network of judges in constitutional courts and supreme courts who are promoting the idea that the European Court of Human Rights should contain more judges from the Constitutional Court and the Supreme Court, while it's precisely their judgments that are overruled in Strasbourg. So it's a bit an interesting debate which is going on there, and it says something about the importance that sometimes one judge can make a difference when it's a 4-3 decision or an 8-9 decision in the Grand Chamber. But in general, of course, the recruitment of judges is something that we need to keep an eye on and to monitor and to be very aware what is happening. Like it is an important factor in the United States, but it's more transparent, I think, here in the United States, what the background is and what the political moments is to decide on new judges. It's a much more complex process in Europe with 47 judges from or 48 judges from 48 member states.
I think most European judges would cringe at the kind of attention the Supreme Court justices get here. Their every thought. Okay, questions.
Can I ask a quick question? So for the 46, I guess, favorably decided Article 10 cases, and in the Serbian case that you mentioned, do you know what the actual practical outcome was? Have the documents actually been turned over? Were fines paid? To what degree were the judgments actually?
Oh yeah. In Europe, the judgments are monitored by not by the court itself, but by the committee of ministers who have a special division in the enforcement and the monitoring of the judgment. So, for instance, when there is a fine, and let's call it a fine that is to be paid, or damages which are to be paid, then it's the committee of ministers through their diplomatic ways who enforce the judgments. When there is an order to hand over the information within a short delay, then it's the committee of ministers which will monitor that, and if it's not done, they make a resolution, and then there is diplomatic pressure on the member states to do that. But sometimes it's not easy. For instance, there has been a case against Azerbaijan where the court decided that Fatulayev, a journalist who was very critical to the government and who was convicted to years, I think 7 years of imprisonment. The European court decided that he need to be released immediately from prison. And the Azerbaijani authorities were not willing to do that, and they found drugs in his cell. So that was an argument to keep him in jail, because there was a charge of possession of drugs. But there was so strong pressure during months by international organizations, NGOs, diplomacy, that after a few months, Mr. Fatulayev was released from jail. So that would have never happened without the court judgment. So it can really make a difference. There is some weak element as well. We are aware of that. So there are situations in Russia, in Azerbaijan, in Turkey, where the court keeps on repeating that the judgments need to be executed, that the law need to be changed, that the jurisprudence need to be adjusted or changed, and it's not happening. We cannot send a military unit from Strasbourg to Ankara or to Baku, let it be to Moscow, that would be totally unthinkable. So we have the tools of political diplomacy, pressure, international pressure. When they meet the ministers and the other colleagues say, come on, you have to change this. But some countries are not very much willing to do that. And I have understood that with regard to Russia, there is a beginning of a procedure eventually to exclude them from membership because of the repeated denial of the execution of judgments by the European Court. But it will be a very long and sensitive procedure. But the Committee of Ministers is the central body monitoring the enforcement of the judgments. Yeah.
I have a question for MLDI. Looking at your annual report, and maybe we could pass those pamphlets there to people who came in. I'm really intrigued by the spread of your cases, and I wondered if you could explain some of the numbers at the central chart. You have cases where you provide direct support, and then you have cases handled by country partners. And how did you make decisions to engage with country partners and explain the breakdown?
In a nutshell, in countries where we see a high level of demand, we actually fund partner organizations. So Kathy, who works for the Human Rights Network for Journalists in Uganda, heads up their legal department, and they handle a large volume of cases on a daily, sort of on a rolling and ongoing basis, and they do that very well. So that is, in a nutshell, is your answer. And in countries where the demand is more sort of incidental, or it doesn't run into the dozens of cases, we typically contracts. We're a little bit like an insurance agency. So a journalist comes to us with a case, and they say, I don't have a lawyer, please help me. We will contract with a lawyer on a case-by-case basis to provide legal defense to that individual journalist. And that ranges. We're not strategic about how we promote it, or not strategic enough, I should say. And it means that we get cases in some strange places. So we have one in Tonga. At the moment, and Tonga is not a place we would choose to litigate, although I understand the beaches are very nice. We haven't had the opportunity to go yet, but that is kind of how it works. So where we see a high level of demand, we will actually go in there proactively and seek out partners to work with. Elsewhere, we sort of mop up on a case-by-case basis.
And there had been talk at early stages of forming councils, regional councils, to identify what would be the cases in which you should get involved. There was great concern at the founding of the organization that you would be overwhelmed with requests.
Yeah.
Have you been overwhelmed? Or
no, and it's really, I think that the regional councils don't, I mean, so that wasn't followed through on, but what happens, what tends to happen is that cases get referred on by people like the CPJ, who have large networks of reporters, or by national journalist associations. Because the natural thing for a journalist when they get into trouble to do is to go to their own union or to their own association and say, help. And so for us, we network with those associations, and we make sure that they know that we exist. more than trying to ensure that every individual journalist or blogger on the planet knows that, that we exist. So de facto, it's that, it's very much that method of getting cases referred on by national associations or by groups like the CPJ or RSF or others.
Peter, can you say a bit more about the balance or the convergence of sort of firefighting cases versus or going into strategic cases? Like the Konate one sounds what we call strategic or whatever, high impact.
But it came from an ordinary...
It came from just a journalist who was in prison. There was no sort of strategic beginning to it. We didn't seek it out. It just was somebody who came to us for help, and we provided the assistance both because we felt that the individual deserved justice. You know, he shouldn't be in prison, and we saw, of course, that it was a strategic opportunity.
But what sort of is there one primary consideration, or you have sort of two dockets? One that cases that you take up because, well, the individual is in serious trouble, or it's an important loss to the local media scene, and developing the law.
Yeah, I mean, it is, in that sense, it is two dockets. There's a large basket of cases that are just sort of churning through, and that don't raise any particular points beyond the importance to the individual journalist or the media outlet concerned. And then there's...
Yes and no, but because each individual case in and of itself is strategic. I mean, it's the whole point about
politically strategic.
It's the whole point about fighting back, right? I mean, every time a journalist fights back, it's pushing back against the people oppressing free speech. So in that sense, I know that you mean something different with strategic. You mean, you know, change in laws and it's an open question.
What is strategic?
but generally speaking, that's more what's considered as strategic cases in which you can kind of. But I do think that each individual case that we can get a good result in is a strategic one, right?
But Dave, what's strategic in your case? How do you decide what to litigate?
When the New York Times gets sued, it's not strategic. But when we go out, in our FOIA litigation, we obviously are making choices about can we move the law more often than to get the documents. The system's so slow here that unless the story is going to always be a story for years to come, why approach it? We do feel very strongly, though, about trying to change doctrine about FOIA, and we'll look for particular cases to do that in.
And so, I mean, you know,
you also have to keep people out of jail
occasionally.
Sometimes,
but compared to firefighting, so it's not very strategic to allow lots of small fires to burn all over the city of New York, right?
Or anywhere.
I can maybe give us another example than what MLDI is also doing in Europe, and that's strategic. For instance, when there is a chamber judgment which it finds no violation, and it contains an important principle, and I don't know if this is off the record or on the record, but I can say it anyway. Then, for instance, the next day already on one of the blogs on Strasbourg Observers or European Court of Human Rights blog, there is a critical blog, for instance, published, and then there is contact between some academics and some of the organizations like Article 19 of Peter's and Annie's organizations trying to make a coalition for request for a referral. And I think that is an enormous strong support, because then the court becomes aware it's not just in this case of a small online news platform in one of these Baltic states. All at once, it seems that the whole community of media, of NGOs, of journalistic organizations is concerned and is very worried about this case. And then this organization plays a role in making the network and organizing a collective action nearly against such a chamber decision. So that is also a kind of a strategic way. And it happened with the Delphi case. I think it also happened with the Pentikäinen case, the journalist, which was convicted in Finland while he was participating in a demonstration and doing his work. And I have also seen sometimes afterwards you jump on the wagon in the case against France about the right of privacy of a head of state. So I think these are instruments where also there is a coalition sometimes between the professional organizations, the stakeholders, the NGOs, and the academic world. I'm not litigating myself like Yaman Akden is in Turkey. I'm not that kind of an activist, because also we need to play our different roles. But I think we can empower each other in this.
And does it reach the courts? I find one of the challenges with this far away international tribunals is that they're far away, and so there's not a national court. They're not, the national media does not cover them in the same way, and they're a little bit twice removed, as it were. Has that changed with time? Do they feel the public pressure? In other words, when there's a judgment that.
I think the panel who has to decide, when they saw this massive support in the Delphi case, they couldn't do else, I think, than refer it to the Grand Chamber. They had nearly the whole world of media and NGOs and journalism against them.
You know, we had a very odd decision in the privacy case that you mentioned. So I think it was with Thomson Reuters and the New York Times and a few other broadsheets, we intervened in what was essentially a tabloid case about the privacy. The entire privacy law of Strasbourg is about the privacy of the royal family of Monaco, right?
and so
we wrote in with a coalition of media companies asking to intervene, and the Grand Chamber allowed us to intervene on our own and expressly disallowed the media companies.
Was it something we said?
I don't know. I mean, it made absolutely no sense, and it's not something that they'd done before. That was very odd, and I think that indicates that yes, it has an impact. And you know, if you have these large media groups that are all coming together and intervening,
did you have the European
formally,
media, or was it?
It was Thomson Reuters. It was the New York Times. It was the Guardian. It was one of the Italian broadsheets.
Yeah.
It was Le Monde. Did we have a French?
Yeah,
Dutch one. So we chose some of the big broadsheets from across Europe, and they were and the European Court Grand Chamber, the president. It's a president's decision, said no. But we allow MLDI in, that's all right, because that's not a big name, apparently. but not the New York Times, not Thomson Reuters.
I mean, it's also if it's got anything to do with the nature of what they see a third party intervention, which is much less partisan than the amici can be in this legal system, for example. It's, I don't know, some sort of a Latin concept of a friend of the court, but just the court, not a friend of other people.
I'm sorry for putting your annual report, but I was wondering what the breakdown is of direct, like, transparent attacks on freedom of the press, like criminal defamation and defamation cases, versus, you know, what we see in Azerbaijan a lot, like heroin, tax evasion, you know, a whole host of other types of crimes.
So the ones that are listed as other criminal charges, and I mean terrorism, I would say, and things like that. So those would be those ones from the list. I'm not good at numbers, but that would give you a sense of the statistics.
Yeah.
Do you know off the top of your head?
No, well, the majority are libel cases, either whether criminal or civil. There's a couple of countries where the others occur, right? So in Azerbaijan, it's always tax evasion.
Vietnam as well.
Vietnam tax evasion,
I was wondering what sort of legal challenges MLDI faces when they're prosecuting cases in so many different jurisdictions, aside from the geographic challenges. I know that you mentioned dealing with the varying rules of procedure and then also trying to pick the appropriate precedent.
Are you referring to the international cases now, or the national ones?
Or when you go to a new court that you haven't been in, just kind of adjusting to that in terms of the...
Learning the rules of procedure.
Yes, like that.
Yeah.
The nitty-gritty.
But with most of these cases, actually, the African court, there was no one to talk to, basically, because no one had gone there yet. So at least no one we knew. But with particularly with the African Commission, I just tried to get information from people who had litigated there before. And then you find out that the rules of procedure actually don't really give the actual procedure, but that there are some other steps that need to be taken and so on. And that has been really helpful, and I've been trying to kind of also share that information with whoever else goes, right? Because, there's just a lot that you learn from people who've had the experience there.
Well, maybe you could talk about how you work with pro bono lawyers.
Sure. That's not
directly
related, but fine. So we have basically a panel of pro bono lawyers from large firms and also individuals that you know have indicated that they're interested in working on the cases that we have on our dockets. It depends a bit on what's necessary in a case. The same way that it depends on what's necessary in a case, how far we get involved. Some things we just do in house because we just have the information ready based on our prior experience. So an example of that is the case that we supported in Zambia last year, in which the false news laws in the country were struck down by the Constitutional Court. They basically wanted comparative and international law arguments on that front. You know, we had that, so we wrote a nice memo for the lawyer so he could use that. And other times you get very much more specific questions, right? And we need to get additional research done. So that's really wonderful to call upon our pro bono panel for. Then there, at the African Court case, once we'd filed that, and actually the same also for the East African Court and the African Commission case that I just mentioned, you know, we filed the case, and after that we went looking for a partner, basically, to kind of, you know, create a slightly larger legal team. Because it's always good, I think, to kind of have several people on board so you can brainstorm a bit, and also because there's a capacity issue, right? We're a really small organization. Getting your, you know, all your authorities in, for example, creating bundles and things like that. These are things that law firms can do wonderfully easily. They have dedicated people to help you with that. For us, that would mean spending a week copying and putting stuff in binders, which is not necessarily the most effective way to go about things. So we've had support with from other firms in all three of those cases, for example, where we basically kind of form a little cross-organizational legal team, and in which we have people to discuss next steps with. They can pitch in with research when we need to do something really ad hoc, help with really practical things such as preparing bundles. And at the African Court case, we had a partner also of the law firm that helped us there, when he'll go to the hearing with us and also, you know, deliver part of the pleading. So does that answer your question, or is that not what you're
saying? Yes, just thinking? That's exactly. Yeah. But in addition, do you cover costs of pro bono? Do you cover the costs of travel to the court hearing?
So yeah, it depends a bit on what the pro bono person in question can do. A lot of the firms can actually, in that case, pay for their own travel. But if we, for example, ask an individual barrister who is, you know, basically our little economic entity in and of themselves, they dedicate their time pro bono, and we make sure that they get there and that their costs in that sense are covered. Yeah. Yep.
I see just behind you.
Yeah, I can't tell who was first.
That's okay. My question is, how does MLDI navigate your own risks in terms of, you know, because in challenging defamation laws or defending those being challenged under those laws, you also run the risk of also being pulled under that as well. Like, for instance, you know, you speak about Thailand, like, just even talking about the law in a poor way also puts you at risk of being charged under it as well. And so how do you navigate that in terms of choosing which cases you approach, or in terms of working with your partners in defending those cases?
We're also not at the forefront ourselves. I mean, we often, because we are so small, we try to work through partner organizations and through others. And so when we work with Kathy, for example, it's you know, Kathy who does all of the court work out there, and our role is in backing that up, both financially and with when she needs it, you know, advice and strategy or whatever. Kathy doesn't need any advice. she knows it all. But so our own sort of exposure in that is very low profile.
Sure.
There isn't a risk. You know, there are some.
There are some countries against which we have a lot of litigation pending. You know, we wouldn't necessarily visit if we could avoid it.
Yeah. How about in terms of like your partners and ensuring that, like, because they're in country and they're working those cases. Like,
that's on my mind a lot.
Yeah.
They know the risks, and I think actually they take on too many risks sometimes, and we certainly actively dissuade them sometimes from putting themselves out.
Okay.
And, yeah.
I see.
I mean, it's the last thing we want to do, right, is to put more people
right,
in
yeah.
That's exactly.
You see very different styles. I mean, people have to make very personal choices in that. You have people who just kind of even up the volume on the activism because they think that getting more attention actually protects them more.
Yeah.
Then you have people who just kind of go a bit more for all the technical angles in defending cases such as these, so just kind of steering clear from the more, you know, principled human rights / political argument. So that, yeah, that differs a lot. But these are things that we do discuss with our parties, but yeah, and we ask, like, so how will this implicate you? Is there anything we can do to help you minimize it? But
Well, it is also their choice. So in Vietnam, you know, the lawyers that we've worked with are either in prison or currently under house arrest, right? And it's not because we asked them to put themselves forward.
Of
and it and they work in extremely repressive regimes, and they know that they are also true believers themselves, right? These are not sort of lawyers who are just sort of doing a technical job. They're activists of them themselves as much as anything else, which also puts them at risk. And that also, so there's risks in that. I mean, in Rwanda, some of the lawyers that we worked with actually said that they deliberately don't have any kind of political profile. They just say, look, we're just doing a legal job, we're just, you know, don't confuse us, don't take us for our clients, we don't share their beliefs, we're just defending their, you know.
Right.
And that works for them, so it's...
Very Voltaire-like. Marina?
Yeah, I have two questions, if I may.
Yeah, yeah.
So for Peter and Nanny, I was curious, does your organization also work on implementation of judgments? Do you, for example, submit briefs to the Committee of Ministers, or do you just focus on the litigation aspect? And my second question relates to what Peter said at the beginning of the talk about one of the trends being that national security and anti-terrorism legislation is being increasingly applied to journalists as well. I was wondering whether you also see a trend in that in Western Europe, and are you getting any cases actually from Western Europe referred to you?
Do the first, you do the second. On implementation, I mean, in the Konaté case, we're now at the reparation stage, so we're still far removed from implementation, actually. Mm-hmm. We just filed on trying to figure out exactly what a year in prison is worth, which is quite difficult to see what you know, the amount of damage you should get. Burkina Faso has also been ordered to change their laws. They have been given 2 years for that, so that's also it's also very far removed. Our European court cases are all in too early a stage to even get there, so we haven't worked with the Committee of Ministers in that sense so far. So, but it is something we're looking, you know, towards, but not just yet.
Okay.
Peter, did you want to?
We don't get a lot of cases referred to us from Western Europe. I think there's a lot of capacity in Western Europe itself, right? And we don't want to duplicate any efforts. We also don't want to tread on any toes on this, you know. And so it's in the UK, there's obviously, you know, a lot of abuse. And we're involved a tiny little bit because we're concerned that... that we shouldn't just be seen to be doing work in, you know, some of the countries that we have mentioned, but that we should also tackle some of them. But it's also because there is a strategic opportunity in some of these cases to push the law, perhaps not push the law forward, but to...
Well, it's more of a strategic decision in the sense that, you know, there's an allocation of resources thing, so you try to allocate them where the need is highest, right? But then there's also that certain decisions coming from the UK, for example, we know will have a huge effect in a lot of the other countries that we work. So the Miranda case, in that sense, you know, protection of sources versus terrorism and so on, that's a kind of an important case not only for the UK, but also for...
Well, and it's for the development, developing the common law. So we did an FOI case in the UK that we got involved in. Also because actually nobody wanted to get involved in it, so we were like, okay, we'll do it. You know? But we also took that because it was partly common law based and it was partly Article 10 ECHR based, and so we wanted to push the Article 10 points, obviously. In the end, the court emphasized the common law aspects of the right to information over the Article 10 aspect. In fact, they rubbished the entire jury. That's now going to Strasbourg on appeal, but that was that ended up being very useful in developing common law, which
you know, the UK Supreme Court's interpretation of that is massively authoritative elsewhere around the world. So that is obvious strategic value in that.
What's the name of that case?
Kennedy. Kennedy versus Charity Commission. And that's going to Strasbourg, yes. Yeah. Kennedy versus, or it's Sunday Times. No, it's Kennedy.
It's Kennedy.
Yeah. Kennedy versus the UK. They've asked for that to be referred to the Grand Chamber.
Also, a stop and search case against the United Kingdom, which was found a breach of Article 8, which was also in the line of anti-terror law and security, but I forgot the name of the case 2 or 3 years ago. And some other cases also. I was thinking about this case against the Netherlands and Bladet, Oostade Bladet, where a magazine received a letter of an organization that claimed a terrorist attack, and in order not to hand over it to the judiciary, they destroyed the document to leave no trace, and they were convicted in the Netherlands for doing that. They got a fine, and the European Court did not find a violation of Article 10 because it was considered as an obstruction of the administration of justice. So you feel also that some national law is applied, and I could also refer to a resolution by the meeting of media ministers some years ago, also very strongly supported by NGOs, where this meeting of media ministers requested all member states of the Council of Europe to review their anti-terror legislation in order not to have collateral damage with regard to freedom of expression and journalistic activities. There was only one country who did not vote the resolution, that was Russia. Yeah. But nothing has happened. And many NGOs have tried to know what is happening with this resolution, but the Council of Europe isn't doing anything with it for the moment. So it's a very sensitive area. The member states don't feel that others need to be involved in that. Yeah.
Okay, last question, Ari, because they have another meeting to go.
Okay. Have you had any requests for assistance from China? And if so, how do you react?
We haven't, and I think our first reaction would be to find somebody who can translate.
This is the Poo's case, though.
Oh, yeah, Poo's case, right. Yeah. Yeah. Do you want to mention
that? You know it better.
This was the only case. This was a Chinese lawyer called Pu Jicheng, who was picked up ahead of the Tiananmen Square anniversary last year, and has been in detention ever since on various public order charges. And he was one of those lawyers who's also a true believer and also an active blogger and a democracy activist. He represents Ai Weiwei is probably his highest profile client. He also represents many other bloggers. And the only thing that we've been able to do for him is to submit a petition to the UN Working Group on arbitrary detention, because that's the only international remedy available to anybody in China. But I think for us right now, we lack the capacity to do much, to do any work in China, realistically. It also takes very specific expertise.
You need specific expertise, but there are lawyers with Chinese language skills and knowledge of Chinese law who could be available.
Mm. Well, maybe it's something to look into.
Next frontier. Great. Thanks to all three of our speakers, especially for doing this after 2 full days of conferencing on free speech. But that's the flip side of that, is that if you want to know more, I think all the materials are on the Columbia website. There was really a very rich collection of presentations on jurisprudence from all corners, not from Tonga, maybe, but most of the globe.
Globalfreedomofexpression.org, right?
Yeah.
Is their website.
Great. Yeah. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.